curve while holding giant cameras on their shoulders. They had also taken a beating. We all agreed to head to a nearby field, have lunch, and take a break.
It was late summer in the valley, and the temperature outside had hit the high 90s. We got umbrellas to shield ourselves from the sun, and despite the heat and the near-death swerve, we were still in pretty good spirits. We gathered in this big, beautiful field, holding umbrellas, having lunch, waiting for our bus to be reassembled. I can't remember who noticed first, but someone commented that we looked like the Georges Seurat neo-impressionist painting, A Sunday Afternoon on the Island of La Grande Jatée. We all took out our cameras. This moment was too random and wonderful not to be documented.
When the time came to get back on the bus, we were assured that the worst was behind us. "Don't worry," the team told us. "Things were a little crazy this morning, but we've got it all figured out now. No more freestyle driving. The bus will always be hooked up to the rig. Straight lines, no stunt drivers." Phew. Plus, they had somehow gotten a portable air conditioning unit. "We can pull it behind the bus with a hose that goes through the sunroof. It's totally quiet, so this afternoon, the bus won't be so hot." We were thrilled. And as we loaded back onto the cool, reorganized bus, everyone relaxed and decided to put the morning behind us. Off we went. No more laughing fits, no more peeing. We were nailing our shots. That's when I noticed a funny smell. "Hey, guys, does anyone else smell that?" I asked. "Nope." "No, seriously, guys, it smells like gas." No one. "Jenna is being sensitive," was the consensus. I mean, I know I was known for having allergy attacks on set because of the tiniest bits of dust, but this was different. "No, stop the bus. I'm serious. It smells wrong." Soon, it wasn't just me. Others piped up. We began debating whether the bus smelled funny. Then our camera operator spoke up. She didn't feel well. She stumbled and set down her camera. Guess what? The portable air conditioning unit's intake hose was right next to the exhaust pipe on the bus. So that hose was sucking in exhaust and blowing it straight into the sunroof of the bus. We were all being slowly poisoned. Or not so slowly, actually.
Now, you guys know my BFF, especially those of you who listen to our Office Ladies podcast. She was not at all happy about, one, being nearly poisoned by exhaust, and two, being ignored when she rightfully pointed out said poisoning. She was fired up, to put it mildly.
My exact words were, "I am not ever getting on that bus ever again." Leslie David Baker backed me up. His eyes were watering like crazy.
So it was off the bus again for a third time. Our medic was waiting when we got off to make sure no one was going to kill over. Our camera operator, Sarah, had a terrible headache for hours. The rest of the crew was trying to air out the bus and reattach the air conditioning tube somewhere besides right next to the exhaust pipe. Meanwhile, the producers were trying to figure out how we could finish shooting this episode. Poor Bryan Cranston. I gave him a big hug. He was so calm and kind, even as the wheels were literally coming off the Dunder Mifflin bus. But there was hope. The producers remembered the pie scene. We hadn't shot the scene where everyone eats pie. Pie makes everyone happy.
That scene was not on the bus, and it involves pie. Well, that's all I needed to hear. I very willingly walked up to the setup for Laverne's Pies, Tires Fixed Also. It felt so good to sit on a bench next to John Krasinski in the fresh, non-toxic air and eat pie. I mean, after the day we'd had, it was the best. I wasn't allowed to pick my favorite pie, strawberry rhubarb, because Pam says rhubarb is her least favorite, so I had blueberry pie, and I was happy. I might have purposely flubbed my lines a few times just to extend the scene and get more pie.
I was only in the background of the pie scenes, but that didn't stop me from eating my heart out. I got my favorite, chocolate cream. You can tell how vividly both Jen and I remember getting pie. The scene took place on the side of the road by an old pickup truck and a little shack. In between takes, Catherine, Kate, and I leaned up against the truck and chatted. Pie mends all things, including near carbon monoxide poisoning.
Just as I finished the last delicious bite of my third helping of pie, Bryan Cranston came over and gently asked, "Jenna, would you consider getting back on the bus? There is just one shot we don't have. I promise, no more accidents. It'll be quick." John looked at me and said, "Come on, we got this." Then he did what only John could do. He started a funny chant about getting back on the bus. He got everyone energized, laughing, happy again. So we all got back on the bus. I'm not going to lie, I was still on edge. I felt slightly traumatized at this point. I mean, who wouldn't? But guess what? We got the scene. It was as simple and short as Bryan had promised it would be. Operation Death Bus complete. Thank God. As we pulled into the parking lot, John was again at the front of the bus, chanting as we clapped and smiled. The day was done. We'd filmed the episode. We'd survived. Then the bus went over a bump, we all stumbled, and John hit his head on the camera next to him. Of course.
So there you have it. The stories of how the cast and crew of The Office almost bit the dust. Twice. Once on a boat, once on a bus. Looking back, we learned a lot about one another in those moments. Our original cast had come a long way together, and no matter what was thrown at us, we would get through it. Bryan will help you into a dinghy in the middle of the ocean. Jenna will detect poisonous fumes. Oscar will make sure you have a place to sit. Phyllis will smile even as you sweat to death. Leslie will put his arm around you. Ellie will remind you to pack extra underwear. Kate will get you a beverage. Rain will be a smartass. Creed, Craig, and Ed will sing you a song as the ship sinks or the bus swerves. And John will make sure you are laughing through it all.
Whether it was in a conference room, on a boat, or on a bus, there is no other group I would have wanted by my side. And it ended up being a pretty amazing episode and final season. P.S. We love you, Bryan Cranston.
Thank you for getting us through such an insane day.
We are very excited because we have a special guest. This person had a hard time saying goodbye to The Office.
She did, and she famously posted her reaction to watching the finale on Instagram. And well, in that moment, she was all of us.
That person was Jennifer Garner.
And she graciously agreed to talk all about it.
Hi, Jennifer!
Hi, guys!
Hi!
We are just about to read the finale chapter of our book, and we just had to reach out because you had a very emotional reaction to watching the finale of The Office, which you posted on Instagram.
I mean, Jennifer, when we think of the finale of The Office, we now think of you and your video because you made us cry.
It's true.
You guys, I lost it. All my kids lost it. We sat on the couch and howled. Like, stop. We must have really needed a good cry because we boo-hooed. We had an enormous reaction for watching a television show. But, you know, that's what art is good for sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Well, what do you think it was about the show or the finale that moved you so much?
Gosh, you know, the finale itself just could not have been more beautifully rendered, more beautifully acted. For me, finales of TV shows, even before I was in one or before I even thought about it, I just hate goodbyes. And so I felt so viscerally that all of your love for each other and the fact that you were saying goodbye, because you know what? You really don't get it back. Even if you see each other, you know, once a week, it still is not the same. It's not the same as the easy cadence of going into work and checking in and going home and being part of each other's lives. I mean, you guys have maintained it, but for the feel of it, it is not the same. So that was one level for me. I mean, I've never watched the finale of Alias because it was too gutting for me to shoot and too awful that last day. I can't even think about it. But then also, we had been with you guys. You know, my kids and I watched two episodes a day, and on the weekends, sometimes we would do three. It was kind of our pandemic treat, and it really became part of the personality of our house. was we lived and breathed it, and we talked about it, and we couldn't wait to get to the next episodes. And so we didn't binge watch. We very carefully and methodically binged into the show, but we lived it with you guys. And so to see it all wrapped up so in such a satisfying way, to see Angela end up, I mean, when Angela says, "I love him," no, Dwight, I can't speak it. It was so perfectly acted and so beautifully done. And then to see when you guys were all sitting up there with, you know, and then suddenly you are working through things, and Creed is in the audience, and you're working through things in real time. And to see Pam and Jim pull it out and figure things out and get to the others, I mean, it was just completely wholly satisfying. But the moment of that Andy says, "Why can't we realize that the good times are happening as they're happening?" That's one of the most universal truths, and we don't say it often enough, and that just smashed me.
We both sighed at the same time. You articulated like everything I felt even as I rewatched it.
Did it kill you guys to watch it?
It wrecked me on so many levels because, like you said, there was the personal part of it and then the part of it that was my character.
I have only watched the finale one time, which was right after it aired. I guess this is the part where I admit that I did not rewatch it while writing this book.
I did.
But I didn't. And I know that eventually for our Office Ladies podcast, I'm going to have to rewatch it again. But Jennifer, I'm like you. It's too much. It's too much for me. Because it's all the things you said.
Jen, we need to rewatch it together. And then we'll all three sob.
You don't even want to see me rewatch it. I mean, we had shirts on, we all matched. We really went for it. And then after that, for one of my kids' pandemic birthdays, we did a combination of, we did the Dundies, the Office Olympics, and I feel like there was something else. Oh, Christmas Party. Well, with the disco. Yeah. And we did all of those episodes as a birth, like just with the people in my house, in our bubble. And it was honestly, I think it's like one of the most fun nights I've ever had in my whole life. It was so much stinking fun. I can't even tell you.
I'm going to have an alias birthday party.
You
and
should.
And I'm just going to cartwheel through the backyard.
You swing in on a rope.
I'm going to have various wigs, lots of wardrobe changes.
You do it. Go for it.
Start training now, Jenna.
I know. I don't know what
start working
this
out.
This needs to be my birthday from 20 years ago.
Oh, Jennifer, we adore you. Please tell us if we can ever come by as Pam and Angela and surprise your kids.
We'd be happy to
do
it.
We'd be happy to. I'll dress up. I have my Argyle sweater.
I kept my skirt and my cardigan.
I mean, by the way, guys, how much fun would we have? That would be really fun. We should... It's not that crazy. We could literally do that.
We could do that.
We could all just show up somewhere. We could just go to the Century City Mall.
Oh my gosh.
I have a red wig.
Go to the Bev Center.
I'm for this.
Yeah.
I'm for this.
Well, thank you so much.
This could not be a better introduction for this chapter. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. You guys have worked so hard. I'm psyched for you. Way to go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Talk to you all. Bye.
Bye.
She is a doll of a human being.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
What a generous and
what a sweet person. Chapter 13. Our Epic Finale.
On May 16th, 2013, the final episode of The Office aired on NBC. It was the culmination of 9 seasons and 10 years of our lives, seen by 5.69 million viewers. What an amazing run. We assumed our show would go the way of most syndicated television comedies at that point, rerunning on cable and slowly slipping into obscurity. But so far, that's not what happened. The Office has found a second life in the streaming world. In 2018, 52 billion minutes of viewing on Netflix alone. We never could have anticipated how much the show would continue to gain fans once it left the air. Who could have predicted that young people who originally watched the show on NBC would grow up and rewatch it with their kids on streaming? It's humbling for sure, and we are so grateful.
Our curtain call. It was August 2012, and the whole cast was sitting on a bus in the Dunder Mifflin parking lot, trying to stay cool amidst a record-breaking heat wave in Los Angeles. We were gearing up for the Work Bus episode, soon to be known as Death Bus. What we didn't share with you before is that early that morning, as we prepared to begin shooting, Greg came on the bus and asked the crew to leave. This was unusual. Greg was very serious, and for a moment, I felt like I was leaving my body. Once we were alone, he shared that NBC had offered to extend the show 2 more seasons, but that many of the cast contracts were up, and he was afraid that we'd lose people to other projects. He expressed concern over what the show would become with only a handful of the original cast. The bus was silent. And then Greg looked at all of us and asked how we felt about saying goodbye on our own terms and making season 9 the last season of The Office. It was a sobering moment as we all contemplated the end of such an important era in our lives. But as sad as we were to say goodbye, we all decided that we'd rather go out together. How often in television do you get to decide that? Almost never.
I knew Greg's talk was coming, but that didn't make it any easier to hear. Over the summer, before we began production on season 9, Greg called John Krasinski and me to talk about the upcoming year. He explained that Rain and Ed were only signed up to do half the season. Ed had some film roles, and Rain was being held by NBC for a possible spin-off series called The Farm. If The Farm didn't get picked up, Rain would be with us for the entire season. But for now, John and I would be the only lead cast members coming back for the full run of episodes that year. He also told us he wasn't sure the entire supporting cast would be back either. Many of our longtime writers, including Mindy Kaling, Jen Salata, Gene Stupnitsky, Lee Eisenberg, and BJ Novak, had left for new projects. It was clear that season 9 could be our last. Greg also told us he would be coming back as showrunner, and he had a vision for a final Jim and Pam storyline that involved their marriage being tested. He asked John and me to come on as producers. This meant we would be going into the writer's room on a regular basis with the intention of weighing in on the Jim and Pam story. As we sat with the news that this was probably our final year on the show, we were, once again, so grateful for Greg's trust in us as creatives. That summer, John and I met with the writers and brainstormed what might happen with Jim and Pam. But we weren't the only ones. After the bus chat, Greg invited every single cast member into the writer's room to pitch ideas for their character's final season.
The writers spent months crafting the final season, considering all we had shared. The toughest nut to crack was the finale. How do you wrap up a series like this? Greg thought it would be interesting to jump forward in time, for the documentary of Dunder Mifflin to have aired, for our characters to have seen themselves and reflect on their journey. The final episode would be an hour long, centered around 2 big events that would bring everyone together, a PBS interview panel with the staff of Dunder Mifflin, and Dwight and Angela's wedding. Greg also shared that he wanted to find ways to incorporate former guest actors, crew, writers, family, and friends into the finale. He wanted it to be a big reunion, and Dwight and Angela's wedding was the perfect way to bring everyone back.
The last table read. I don't think any of us expected just how emotional the experience of filming the last episode would be. The feeling started with the final table read. I was hoping our last table read could be held in the same building we'd used for years. But we were filming on location that week, so going back to our stages was not an option. As soon as I walked into the room, I realized there was no way to have used our regular space anyway. Normally, our table reads were in one of the writers' trailers, because we were a small group. For our series finale, we needed a cafeteria-sized room. Almost 100 people were there. There were so many actors in this final episode that long tables were placed in a giant U-shaped configuration with Greg at the center. We all had microphones, there was a photographer, and everything was videotaped. The tables were facing rows and rows of chairs filled with network executives, crew members, agents, managers. As I sat down at my spot, I looked around the room. It seemed as if everyone who had ever worked on the show was there. I was overcome with emotion, the most prevalent being gratitude. I squeezed Angela's hand, and the tears started.
Jen and I walked from set together to the big room they had reserved for the table read, holding hands as we walked into the crowd. I was shaking. I was so full of emotion. I was thankful that Jen and I were seated next to each other. Greg started by telling us what the show meant to him. His whole speech is beautiful. It is on YouTube if you want to check it out. Greg had asked Ken Kwapis to direct the finale. Ken had directed our pilot episode, helping to create the look and feel of Dunder Mifflin, so it was only fitting that he would close out the show. Greg thanked everyone for coming, and when he got to Ken, he said, quote, "I'm very happy and proud to have Ken Kwapis back to direct our finale. Ken was the country vet who birthed this puppy, and now he's going to put it down." Greg then warned us that things were about to get very sentimental. He asked us to open our scripts to the first page, and there was the famous Allison Jones Polaroid from the very first table read of The Office. Greg read the cast list for the final time, and as he said each actor and the character they played, I began to cry. So many little goodbyes. As filming began, we realized we were going to have a million little goodbyes, along with the big ones. For me, these started with my final wardrobe fitting. I was standing there, looking at myself as Angela Martin in her wedding dress, when I turned to our costume designer, Alicia Raycraft, and we had a big, tearful hug. Angela Martin was marrying the man of her dreams. I love that I got to say goodbye to this character on such a happy day in her life. Literally everything was emotional. Vartan's last batch of albondigas soup. It was legendary. The last time Sergio made his famous salsa. Our last bullpen scene, and on and on. Every moment brought tears. I was trading emails with Steve during this time, and he asked me how it was going into that last stretch. I told him we were a bit of a mess, and that I was making a scrapbook for everyone and feeling very nostalgic. It had been 2 years since Steve was on our show, but there he was, still checking in on us. Little did I know that I would see Steve in just a few weeks at Dwight and Angela's wedding. At this point, we'd been told that he would not be returning for the finale. It must have been so hard for him to keep that a secret.
As promised, Greg brought back a ton of characters, most notably Devin, the man who fought not to be fired by Michael on Halloween in season 2. When Creed went in to talk with the writers about what he'd like to see in our final season, he asked for two things: to play one of his songs in the finale, and to bring back Devin. Creed and Devin had stayed in touch after Devin left for New York. Greg liked Creed's idea, and Devin came back for a cameo in the final episode. Perhaps one of the most emotional days was when we shot the question and answer panel scenes. Greg had members of our writing staff asking the questions. He also cast Jenny Tan, the creator of the Office fan site OfficeTally.com, as the woman who asked Pam why she didn't trust Jim's love. He cast his wife Suzanne Daniels as the moderator. Greg also used this opportunity to wrap up a few of the characters' storylines. The scene where Erin finally meets her birth parents, played by Joan Cusack and Ed Begley Jr., gets me every time. It is so emotional. When we finished shooting, the entire auditorium of background actors stood up and applauded. The cast all cried and took a bow. It was incredibly moving.
Despite the tears, there was still a lot of laughing and levity, including pranks. We had one final conference room scene, for which Ken had to choose where we would sit depending on the reaction shots he needed. Our assistant director made little post-it notes with our names on them and stuck them to the chairs so we knew where to sit during rehearsals. At one point, Oscar put his arm around me as I sat down. I thought that was so sweet. I'm not sure how long I had the Oscar sign on my back, but it was long enough for Jenna to take a photo. Well played, Oscar.
I've shared before that some of my favorite moments from the series were when we had storylines with just the women in the office. I was happy to see the finale had an all-ladies scene, Angela's bachelorette party. We shot the bachelorette party late into the night on location in a funky little farmhouse. Between camera setups, we hung out on couches laughing and snacking like teenagers at a sleepover. It was the girl time I'd hoped for. It was during this shoot that Ellie and I discovered the deliciousness that is raisin rosemary crisps from Trader Joe's. I think we ate 4 boxes. We couldn't stop. Catering ran out. Several years ago, I got a mysterious gift for my birthday. A giant jar filled with Raisin Rosemary Crisps. I knew immediately it was from Ellie.
My memories of the bachelorette scenes are a mixture of laughter and of pure embarrassment. I was very excited that my friend Rachel Harris had joined as Angela Martin's sister. Rachel and I met while studying at the Groundlings Theater in our 20s, and we've been friends ever since. Then there were the stripper scenes. Oh my God! The writers brought back Spencer Daniels, the actor who had played Meredith's son Jake in Take Your Daughter to Work Day. He was all grown up now. Jake and Meredith both gave Angela Martin awkward lap dances. If you rewatch, I put my hand over my face because I am beet red. Aw, look at that! I worked beets into this chapter. Dwight would be so proud.
The wedding. The finale also had a few stunts, the most notable being when Dwight fires a bazooka during his bachelor party. But did you know that Angela and Phyllis had their own stunt? On her wedding day, Angela Martin has leg pain from the night before when Mose kidnaps her and hides her in the trunk of his car. This is part of a Schrute wedding tradition called Brautenführen. Angela blames Phyllis for leaving the door open, thus giving Mose the opportunity to kidnap her. To make it up to Angela, Phyllis promises to get her down the aisle. This simple promise in the script resulted in a complicated stunt.
It wasn't safe for Phyllis to physically carry me down the aisle, so we had to fake it. First, a camera filmed us from behind, showing us walking down the aisle toward Dwight. A young stunt woman who resembled Phyllis carried me on her back. You couldn't see her face, so we were able to sell her as Phyllis. Then the camera was moved to the front of the ceremony, where Dwight was waiting for me, so we had to walk directly toward the camera. You could definitely see our faces, which meant no more stunt woman. For this shot, they built a long wooden plank with 2 poles on each end to hold me. I sat on the plank and 2 stuntmen lifted me up behind Phyllis. Imagine a medieval queen being carried through the streets on a palanquin by her subjects, but not that elaborate. I wrapped my arms around Phyllis's neck, but my weight was supported by the 2 men. We had to practice the timing of our collective walk several times. Phyllis couldn't get too far ahead, or I would fall forward. The men behind her had to keep me at a specific height, or I would pull Phyllis backward. In one rehearsal, I started to slide off the wooden plank, and the men almost dropped me. After a few tries, we got it, but even as we started filming, I wasn't sure if we were going to pull it off. In post-production, they used CGI to edit the 2 men and the plank out of the scene. There you have it! Phyllis carries Angela down the aisle to her grave to marry Dwight.
But perhaps the biggest stunt we pulled off was getting Steve Carell back for the shoot without anyone finding out. This involved a months-long campaign. Steve always said he would come back for the finale, provided the storyline was not centered around Michael Scott. He didn't want to come in after 2 years away and steal everyone's thunder. When Greg told him the idea that Dwight and Angela would be getting married in the finale, Steve agreed that Michael would be there. Greg pulled me, John, and Rain aside a few days prior to tell us the news, swearing us to secrecy. Then Rain turned to me and said, "Jenna, not even Angela." Oh man, do you have any idea how hard that was for me? All the secrecy was because Greg wanted Steve's appearance to be a surprise for the audience. He didn't even tell NBC about his plan. In fact, he turned in a script that included a scene between Dwight and Creed before the wedding, not Michael. It had the same page count as the scene between Dwight and Michael. That way, the scene could be scheduled into the day and budgeted for shooting. On the day of the shoot, Creed's name was even on the call sheet for that scene, but it was all a huge ruse.
Early in the morning on our first day of wedding scenes, I was making my way to the hair and makeup trailer when our second AD whispered to me, "Steve's here." I was shocked. It was a foggy day, and as I opened the door to the trailer, this burst of light spilled out, and in the middle was Steve. I screamed, "Steve!" He smiled so big and said, "Ange!" I immediately teared up and we hugged. I could not believe he had come back. There was such an electricity in the air that morning. I also could not believe my BFF didn't tell me. I mean, Jenna, I get it. I'm impressed, but still.
I was so excited when Angela finally knew the secret. Now all of us had to keep it. Greg made an announcement to everyone on set that day, the crew, cast, background performers, asking all of us to stay quiet. I kind of can't believe we pulled it off. The fact that Instagram didn't exist yet was likely a big factor. Greg's biggest worry was that if NBC knew about Steve's return, they would turn it into a press opportunity to build excitement for the finale, and it would ruin the surprise for the audience. When Greg turned the episode into NBC, he had different scenes edited in as placeholders for the ones where Steve appeared. He didn't let NBC see the real footage until the day before it aired. We all had to do massive amounts of press in the weeks leading up to the finale, and everyone lied and said Steve hadn't come back. John Krasinski even lied to David Letterman.
Then came time for Dwight and Angela to exchange vows. Right as Angela climbs into her shallow grave, Michael gives her a hug. Steve improvised that in the first take, and I thought I was going to completely lose it. And then Angela turns to Dwight. I was already tearing up. Then we turned and faced our wedding guests. These were not just the faces of Dunder Mifflin for me. These were the faces of my friends for nearly a decade. 9 years of memories washed over me. I cried several times throughout the ceremony, and you can see me wiping away tears. The only thing that kept me from completely breaking down was how cold I was. The wind was really blowing, and I was freezing. Between takes, I took a photo of everyone looking at Rain and me so I could remember that beautiful, cold, windy moment forever.
When I think of this scene, all I remember is the wind. I literally remember nothing else. Wind and cold. I kept trying to block the wind using John Krasinski's broad shoulders. It didn't work. But if you watch the episode, you can see me burying myself into his shoulder to stay warm.
The reception. Well, the wind was just the beginning of our weather issues. As we got ready to film the wedding reception, a big storm appeared on the horizon. The lanterns the set dressers had hung began to sway, and there was worry our tent might come apart. It started to lightly rain, and we huddled together in the tent or sought refuge in the farmhouse. Thankfully, the storm passed by quickly, and the tent held steady, so we were able to get to the fun part, Angela and Dwight's first dance. In the script, Dwight and Angela dance to Angela by Motley Crue, celebrating Dwight's love of heavy metal. Rain improvised picking me up and twirling me around. I purposely let my legs flail about. We were having the best time. I think about Dwight choosing that song and how perfect it was on that stormy day.
My personal favorite moment from shooting the reception was sitting with Steve. It was my chance to be alone with him and catch up. He told me that life after the office had been good. He was able to be home for more family dinners, more bedtimes, more school concerts. Despite being one of the industry's biggest movie stars, Steve's main topic of conversation was always his love of family. Ironically, in the scene, Michael is showing Pam photos of his children with Holly and telling her stories about them. And that is just what we were doing.
I was sitting with Rain, Jenna, and John when Steve had his final talking head during the reception. Michael says, "I feel like all my kids grew up, and then they married each other. It's every parent's dream." And when the camera pushes past him, you can see the four of us laughing. Those laughs were real. You might also notice that I am incredibly animated for my character, and that is because in that moment, I am not Angela Martin Schrute. I'm Angela Kinsey, and I am telling an insane story. I have no idea how this conversation started, but Rain was telling us he once had a tapeworm as a child when he lived in Nicaragua. One day, while he was walking, his bottom itched, and he reached up and pulled a small tapeworm out of his butt. I feel okay sharing the story because Rain has told it many times, and it is also in his book, The Bassoon King. Seriously, go to chapter 2, titled The Worms of Nicaragua. Not to be outdone, I then launched into my own story about my sister and a tapeworm incident while we were growing up in Indonesia. It lived in her belly for years. She's fine now, no need to worry. We were all grossed out, but also laughing hysterically. I know this might ruin the moment for some fans, but we were laughing about tapeworms during that famous Michael talking head. For me, it makes the moment even more special.
Thinking back to the four of us laughing about tapeworms gives me the warm fuzzies. That's us in a nutshell. After the wedding reception, the PBS crew throws a big wrap party for everyone in the Dunder Mifflin warehouse. This scene warms my heart because this is when Pam's mural is finally revealed. She has painted everyone in the office and suggests they take a group photo in front of it. As the camera pans across the room, so many amazing people who made the show possible are featured, including Greg Daniels, who is right beside Pam, grinning. Our casting director, Allison Jones, our script supervisor, Veda Samarne, our executive producer, Howard Klein, and our editors, Claire Scanlon and Dave Rogers, are all there, too. Incidentally, when you finally hear the voice of the documentarian, it is Dave Rogers. We had talked about who it should be. Some people thought it should be Greg, or Ken Kwapis, or even Ricky Gervais. In the end, we chose Dave. He was the perfect choice. He worked on the show every day since the second episode and probably watched more footage than anyone.
Dwight and Angela decide to put their honeymoon on hold and join the rest of the Dunder Mifflin employees at a secret after-party in the office bullpen. As Creed sings All the Faces, the camera pans around the office bullpen one last time. The end is near, and there is a weight to the room. We can all feel it. And then Jenna has her final talking head. The cast gathered in a tiny room next to the soundstage to watch her. There was a sofa in the corner, and we piled on top of it and waited for her to say the last lines of the whole series. On the stage, Jenna and Ken went through the final beats of her dialogue. I filmed us watching Jenna say her final lines.
I thought it was weird when you picked us to make a documentary. But all in all, I think an ordinary paper company like Dunder Mifflin was a great subject for a documentary. There's a lot of beauty in ordinary things. Isn't that kind of the point?
It was an emotional moment for us in that little video room. I can't imagine how Jenna felt saying it.
When I first saw the shooting schedule, I noticed that Pam's talking head was scheduled last. That meant the entire cast would have been sent home, and I'd have to end the series as the only actor on set. I went to Greg and Ken and asked if there was any way to change that because I didn't want to be alone. Greg and Ken told me that it would be poetic for the last scene we shot to be the final line of the show, but they understood how I felt. They changed the schedule so that my talking head was the second to last shot, followed by a group shot of all of us leaving as Pam takes her painting off the wall.
I can't express how special it was for all of us to be together in that final scene, ending the series together. Even though it was a simple scene, just the group leaving the office, the entire cast felt the weight of the moment. On action, we would walk out the front door and into the lobby. Then, out of view of the camera, we'd file into the narrow hallway by the elevators and wait to hear if Ken would say, "Cut, going again," or "Cut, that's a wrap." With each take, we grew closer to "That's a wrap," and the show being over. The air was heavy with anticipation. I remember I was standing next to Phyllis in the hallway, and we held hands waiting to hear what Ken would say each time. Greg kept making small adjustments. I don't think he wanted it to end either. After a few takes, Ken had the crew gather in the bullpen so they could be there when we finished. We knew it would be soon. On action, we walked out of the office one last time and gathered in the hallway. There was a pause that felt like forever. And then it was Greg, not Ken, who yelled, "Cut! That's a wrap!" We disintegrated into tears and poured into the bullpen and to the arms of our crew. It was fitting that Greg, who had created this amazing world of Dunder Mifflin, was the one to say our collective goodbye. Packing up. After lots of hugs and even more tears, you'd think we couldn't cry anymore, but we did. It was time to pack up our trailers and get to the wrap party across town. As I was loading my car, I looked over and saw John putting the Dunder Mifflin sign into his trunk. I couldn't help but laugh. We all took little mementos from the show. The props department gave me the giant portrait of Angela Martin that hung in her home with Robert Lipton, the state senator. I took Angela's cat paperclip holder, I kept the ring that Dwight gave me when he proposed. You know, when he ran me off the road and shouted his love for me through a megaphone and then gave me the ring that had been in his grandmother's butt, put there by the gangster patriarch of the Coors dynasty, melted in a foundry by the Mennonites. That ring. I still have it.
I took Pam's candy dish, purse, and wonky giraffe pen, which never worked but was on her desk for all 9 seasons. Earlier in the week, I had gone into the wardrobe trailer and swiped one of Pam's old cardigans and a skirt. When I was supposed to turn in Pam's wedding rings, I couldn't. I kept them. They are fake, just sterling silver and cubic zirconia. I also kept her watch. But what I wanted most of all was Pam's watercolor of the Dunder Mifflin office. I had asked for it and been told that it had to be cataloged and returned to storage in case we ever revived the show. I was heartbroken. But that night, as I was leaving, our prop master Phil Shea met me at my car. You should have that watercolor. What about cataloging? I asked. Shh, I'll make a color copy. They'll never know the difference. The day after our finale aired, our line producer Steve Burgess emailed me to see how I was feeling and to say Phil had made good on his promise. The original is hanging in my foyer today.
The finale airs. It was a few months before the finale aired. We had all gone our separate ways, but for the most part, it felt like a typical hiatus. I filmed a new television pilot for Fox, visited my family in Texas, and started to tackle all the home projects I'd been putting off. At first, I began with simple chores like organizing my pantry, and then as the weeks went on, I decided to knock out a wall or two. 3 months into the show being over, I had completely gutted my kitchen. I remember Jenna calling and asking if I was okay. I told her that it was finally hitting me that the show was over. I was clearly trying to self-soothe, the only way I knew how, with complete chaos.
The week after we wrapped, I flew to New York with my family to star in an off-Broadway play at MCC Theater. I'd always wanted to do professional theater, but more than anything, I needed the distraction. I knew the reality of the show ending would hit me hard. The crazy part was that the night of our first audience preview was the same night as the finale. Just as I was walking on stage in my first big theater role, the finale of The Office, the thing that launched my career, was airing. Insane, right?
The day of the finale also happened to be my sister's birthday. I started the day by making her a video of my plants. She loves to garden as much as I do. Then I sent her a video from my daughter and me wishing her a happy birthday. My phone began dinging with messages. My first thought was it was my sister replying to my plant photos and birthday videos, but it was my friends and coworkers from the office with messages about the final episode set to air that night. Then I had a realization. The show wasn't truly over until the last episode aired. After that night, there would be no more episodes. Dwight would never walk up behind Angela and ask for cookie. Meredith would never flash us again, and we would never know what happened to Jim and Pam in Austin. I was so attached to these characters. I felt a loss that I can't put into words. Greg graciously offered to host a final viewing at his agency, WME, where there was a very fancy screening room. He invited anyone who was in town to come. It was a bittersweet night because not all the cast was able to attend. My BFF was in New York City. How was I going to get through it without her? I sat with one of our producers, Steve Burgess, and Craig Robinson. The whole evening was very emotional. I was trying to keep it together because I didn't want to ugly cry on their shoulders. And when the final scene played and I began to sob, Steve Burgess put his arm around me. I couldn't process any of it until I spoke to Jenna. And she was on stage in New York.
As I stood backstage in New York, waiting for curtain, my mind was on my castmates back in Los Angeles. Viewing parties had been such a staple of our experience together, and here I was missing the very last one. Coincidentally, BJ Novak was also in New York that night. He came to see my show, and we toasted the finale. I had big feelings about The Office ending. On the one hand, I was ready. After the play ended, I knew I wanted to have another baby. The stress of juggling a full-time television role and a newborn had been rough. On the other hand, I also knew I was going to miss everyone. It wasn't just that I would miss seeing Rain or Brian or Kate. I was going to miss seeing Dwight, Kevin, and Meredith. Rain I could grab lunch with, but Dwight was now gone forever. When I got back to where we were staying, I watched the episode with my husband Lee and called Angela.
I think we talked for almost 2 hours that night. We talked about the finale, and then Jenna told me all about her play, and I told her about my bold choice to order blue kitchen cabinets. I remember being so thankful. Thankful for this beautiful show. Thankful for how it blessed my life. Thankful for the friendships it brought me. And so very thankful that it gave me my lady, my life anchor, my BFF.
As I was crying with my best friend and reminiscing about our time on the show, I also remember feeling so grateful for everything The Office had given me. But the greatest thing was exactly what Steve had told us it would be, our friendship. The Office changed my career. It gave me financial security. It gave me access to experiences I'd never have had otherwise. But most of all, it gave me a best friend.
Chapter 14. Boss Ladies.
This part of a book is often referred to as the wrap-up chapter. It's where we ride off into the sunset, nostalgic and grateful for our 9 years of working at Dunder Mifflin, filled with magical memories and wondering what comes next. Well, we can tell you exactly what comes next. Office Ladies. Because these two gals are not ready to wrap things up. In fact, we are just getting started.
As soon as The Office ended, our lives and jobs took us in different directions, literally. Jenna moved to New York for a play, then London for a TV show, then San Diego for another play, while I did film and TV projects in Canada, Louisiana, Georgia, and Florida. Gone were our daily BFF lunches and journaling out loud. Gone was even being in the same city at the same time. But even though we were both all over the place, often in different time zones, we had an unspoken commitment to staying in touch. At first, we were mostly texting and emailing, but eventually we discovered we could best communicate by sending each other voice memos. This was perfect for us because we were staying in touch the best way we knew how, by talking. We would trade multiple long voice memos every day. The messages might contain anything, venting about the broken knob on our washing machine, a story of our kids doing something adorable, asking advice about a big meeting coming up, or basically just rambling on and on. We soon took to calling them Ramblies, and they seriously got us through many ups and downs over those early post-office years.
When I got near the end of the run of the play in New York, I started getting very anxious about the future. The office was over, the play was in its final weeks, and I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do next. And although I had my family with me, I really missed my home in California. I left Angela a long rambly, telling her how the nonstop energy of New York was wearing on me. I distinctly remember that while I was leaving the message, I spilled hot coffee all over my arm trying to navigate my son's stroller through the park. The next day, I woke up to a video from Angela. She had gone to my house, of course she has a key, and made a little movie, filming the knickknacks on my shelves, the sunset from my porch, my favorite coffee mug, and our backyard. She left me a rambly reminding me that my home would always be my home, and although I was in a time of transition, it would sit peacefully waiting for me to return. It was exactly what I needed. Then, an hour later, she sent another rambly, this one from the hospital. She told me that after she sent the video, she tripped on the bottom step of my staircase and broke her toe. She was getting fitted for a boot that she would have to wear for weeks. But she said it was worth it because she knew her best friend needed her help. A few days later, she surprised me by flying to New York, wearing the boot, to see my play. In an odd twist of fate, years later, I would break my pinky toe at her house. We have both broken toes at each other's houses. Over the next several years, it was rare for us to both be home in Los Angeles at the same time. But because of Ramblies, I always knew what she was doing and what she was feeling, and she me.
We could be on either side of the world and still stay in touch. When she was in London, I remember the sound her feet made when she walked on the rocky path in Hampstead Heath. She left me daily Ramblies from those walks. Sometimes she would be pushing her daughter in a stroller, and sometimes she would be on her own. I began to look forward to the sound of the rocks crunching beneath her feet. It was soothing to me. Then there was the time I was working in Canada, and I couldn't sleep. I was at a crossroads in my life and struggling to know if I was on the right path. I went on an early morning bike ride around English Bay, leaving Rambleys for Jenna all along the way. She responded right away, and even though we were thousands of miles apart, she helped me process all that I was feeling. I texted her a picture in the moment, and she did the same back to me. It was like she was there with me in Canada, and I was there with her in London.
Eventually, my kids started school, and I didn't want to keep pulling them out of their routine as we traveled the world for work. So, I accepted a regular role on a Los Angeles-based series called Splitting Up Together. Almost everything about this job was perfect. The cast and crew were amazing, the studio was close to our house, the role was fun. I was even reunited with some of the office crew, and Angela popped in as a guest star. The only downside was the hours. With 5 a.m. call times and late evening wraps, I was home, but I was missing school concerts, costume parades, and parent-teacher conferences. I loved acting, but the job was pulling me away from too many of the parenting moments that I cherished and that I knew would too soon disappear forever. I started craving a job that I could do while my kids were at school and that I could put away when they got home.
After years of traveling for work, I felt the same way. We started trading Rambleys about how we might be able to better shape our lives. We daydreamed about what our lives would be if we were in charge, if we were the bosses. It was a conversation I had many times with my own sisters, about the struggle of providing for your family but not sacrificing precious milestones with your children because of work. Trying to find that balance is not easy, no matter what your profession. But in the entertainment industry, there's the added element of odd, erratic hours. I was craving a set schedule that I could count on and plan around. Jenna and I both never wanted to miss another soccer game or dance recital, and we needed jobs that gave us that kind of structure. We sat down and made a wish list of what we wanted. In addition to having control over her own schedule, Jenna laughed and said she'd like to earn a living while being in sweatpants. That lady loves a drawstring pant. I know that one of the main reasons she took that job in London was because she was playing a woman who spent every episode in a jumpsuit. She gleefully told me it was like wearing pajamas to work.
Side note, I'm wearing sweatpants right now.
With a drawstring.
I've also slept in these pants.
Did you sleep in them last night?
Not last night, but it's been done. I was sharing all of these feelings with my co-star at the time, Oliver Hudson, and he said, Jenna, what you and Angela should do is a podcast. I'm telling you, that job is going to tick all the boxes for you. You should really look into it. The following week, June Diane Raphael was a guest star on the show. I knew her from her role on Grace and Frankie, but she also has a podcast called How Did This Get Made? I asked a lot of questions. She had a lot of answers. Oliver was right. Podcasting would tick all the boxes. As soon as we wrapped for the day, I called Angela.
The minute I answered the phone, Jenna yelled in my ear, Podcast! We should do a podcast! You don't even have to wash your hair! Of course, Jenna and I knew nothing about podcasting. If you asked me to write and pitch a television show, I'd know exactly who to call and what to do. I've sold 5 TV shows and had a development deal, but podcasting was completely foreign to me. But just the idea that we could be our own bosses and set our own schedules and produce and create our own content was so enticing, we knew we had to follow this thread. We started by listening to many, many podcasts in a variety of genres. We noticed there was a subgenre called rewatch podcasts. A light bulb went off. Who better to host a rewatch podcast than the people who were on the show? Joshua Molina, who had been on The West Wing, was co-hosting a popular rewatch, and it got us thinking. We decided to do a test run. Jenna came over to my house, and we set my iPhone between us and hit record. She had a fully outlined document, of course. I had a stack of colorful note cards. We rambled for about 45 minutes. My husband, Josh, is a great editor, and he cut together a demo for us to listen to. Later that evening, he asked me if we had listened. We hadn't, as the day had gotten away from both of us. He said, I think you guys are pretty good. I really liked it. Now, if my husband says he likes something, you better take note. He is not from overly verbose stock. We both listened and then immediately called each other. I said, I think we can do this. I loved it. And Jenna said, Lady, Lee loved it. I loved it. Let's do it. It gave us the boost we needed to give podcasting a try.
I'm sure by now you know us well enough to know that we saved it, and we want to play it for you. So here's a little clip from our podcast demo.
I'm sorry in advance for the eating noises. That's me. Sorry.
Okay, this is March 7th. It is Jenna's birthday. She is 45 today.
I am.
We just went on a hike for her birthday. And now we are sitting in what was once my rundown garage that we have made into my office.
Office slash guest room. Slash
pool house. Slash kid
game
hangout.
Room. Mm-hmm,
game room. Yeah. I am eating a turkey wrap and chips and salsa, so I hope that's not annoying.
Well, I'm just really excited to listen to this later and hear your chips. I think that is going to be really fun for
it's
me.
It's the gift that keeps on giving, Jenna.
All right. So it was my job to dive deep into the Halloween episodes. Not just the Halloween episodes, but just Halloween in general on The Office, because it was a very special time.
It was. We had a lot of fun.
And I was thinking about why. Why was it such a very special, highly anticipated holiday on the set of The Office? Well, first of all, Pam always had candy on her desk. And one of my favorite candies, personally, is candy corn.
You love candy corn.
While we didn't know much about podcasting, we both had experience building an acting career from scratch. We'd practiced perseverance. We knew how to be scrappy. Then, during The Office, we learned together how to navigate the world of marketing and publicity, how to pitch, produce, and write our own projects, and how to build our own brand. When it came to starting our new business of podcasting, we weren't totally starting from scratch. We had the benefit of our experience, our name recognition, and a few relevant connections. My husband Lee recommended we call his friend Jeff, who used to work in podcasting, and ask him some advice. Jeff agreed to meet with us. So we got together and started asking questions. How do you produce a podcast? Do we need to buy microphones, rent a studio? How do you upload a podcast? How much does an editor cost? He patiently answered our questions, then started talking about potential download numbers, ad sales, reach. He had charts and graphs. He suggested we start an LLC. He said we needed a lawyer, we needed to trademark our name. We were stuck on, but where do we buy the microphones? It was around this time that I realized who we were talking with. Lee's friend Jeff was Jeff Ulrich, one of the founders of the podcasting giant Earwolf.
Jeff listened to our demo and told us we had a hit on our hands. His actual words were, "You have the special sauce." He told us we should absolutely run with our idea. Can you get a better vote of confidence than that? Over the next few months, we talked to probably a dozen more people. We spoke with podcast producers and hosts and engineers. I am so grateful to each and every one of them for speaking with us. I can't tell you how many stupid questions we asked along the way. I mean, we asked the co-founder of Earwolf where to buy microphones. We probably would have asked him where to plug them in. I cringe thinking back to that time. But that's what it takes when you are plowing a new path for yourself. You have to ask dumb questions, to not know things, to feel silly and vulnerable. Putting yourself out there is part of the journey when you start a new chapter in life, and asking questions is all part of the process. After all those conversations, we basically had to decide whether we wanted to produce our podcast independently or partner with an existing podcast company.
We took meetings with several podcasting companies. We played them our demo and pitched them our ideas. I was also Googling how to publish a podcast and best microphones for podcasts, just in case we still wanted to do it on our own. Microphones became a minor obsession for a while, but they are important for podcasting. Almost as important as the sweatpants. After all our research and meetings, I told Angela I didn't think we could do this on our own and achieve our goal of only working while the kids were at school. There was still so much we didn't understand about this world, and even though it meant sharing the profits, we needed a partner. The company we'd loved most from our many meetings was, ironically, Earwolf. They understood our vision, and we liked their slate of other shows. The one thing we weren't sure of was when we could do this. I was still working on Splitting Up Together, and Angela was in New Orleans shooting the movie Tall Girl for Netflix. When could we be in the same room, in the same city, to actually build this podcast? Then a crazy thing happened. My television show got canceled. Angela wrapped her movie. Earwolf offered us a deal. Well, the moment had finally come. Angela and I had a big heart-to-heart. To get this off the ground, we would have to turn down other jobs and focus 100% on the podcast for a while. It was scary. But this was our chance to be our own bosses, to call the shots ourselves. We'd never had that before. We decided to bet on us, and Office Ladies was born. We started a media company. We named it Ramble, in honor of the many rambling messages we have left each other over the years. It seemed fitting that our company name reflect how we kept our friendship going through hours and hours of rambling and sharing and journaling out loud. Office Ladies would be our first production, and Earwolf was our partner.
When we stepped into the Earwolf studios for the first time, we were, as my daughter says, nervous-sighted. Starting with the pilot seemed too daunting, so we decided to begin by recording Basketball from season one, since that is the one that solidified our best friendship. We hadn't really discussed how we would prepare or what we would say. We just agreed to both watch the episode and come in with notes on what we wanted to share. We thought it was important that we surprise each other, so our reactions were genuine. When we sat down, Jenna got out her 12-page document outlining the episode with notes, facts, and trivia. I set out my 140 brightly colored note cards with time codes, background observations, and my own research. This seemed like a good sign since that was exactly what we'd done for our demo. Sam Kiefer, our sound engineer, told us he was ready when we were. We sat there and blankly stared at each other. We didn't know how to start. How ironic that after years and years of nonstop talking, now that it was literally our job to speak, we didn't know how to begin a conversation. We eventually found a way in and stumbled our way through our first official studio recording of Office Ladies. The next week, we tackled healthcare, which included our first interview with none other than Rainn Wilson. We knew he would be kind to us as we were new to podcasting. When we got those first recording sessions back, we loved Rainn, but hated the part where we broke down the episode.
They were a mess. We were all over the place. I remember standing in the kitchen at Earwolf talking with Angela about what to do. We wanted a polished, entertaining, informative show. We knew we could do better. So we did it again. And again. And again. We recorded and re-recorded three different versions of Basketball and Healthcare. We would save some things, cut others, and re-record. We affectionately call these the Frankenstein episodes. It was during this time that we discovered how we could both contribute to the structure of the show. I came up with the idea of fast facts, while Angela dove into deleted scenes and DVD commentaries. We would both reach out to cast, crew, writers, directors, and producers for different behind-the-scenes details. We found our three-act structure, and the show was solidified. The podcast became two things: an informational The Office rewatch, and two best friends sharing about their lives. And it worked. Now we just had to announce it to the world.
We flew to New York for a press tour. We had done this many times over the years for The Office, but this time it was different because we were traveling to announce a project we had created ourselves. At each press event, we were listed as the co-creators of Office Ladies. I have been in this business a long time, and seeing my name listed like that was a dream come true.
For me, the highlight of our press tour was when the New York Times called and asked to do a piece on us. I've been getting the New York Times delivered to my house for years. This was an honor. The Office had been covered in the Times, of course, but this was about something I had created with Angela. We were in New York when the paper came out, and I'll never forget running to the newsstand to get copies. Oh my God, there we were. We jumped up and down, squealing. It wasn't so different from Booze Cruise when Angela found out she'd become a series regular on the show. It's too bad Oscar wasn't there to snap a photo. Angela and I both framed the article and put it in our home offices.
The podcast premiered on Wednesday, October 16th, 2019. We grabbed breakfast that morning and told each other that no matter what happened, we were proud of what we had done. We hoped people would listen so that we could continue to work together. Earwolf had told us that a successful podcast gets about 50,000 downloads in 30 days. They were hoping our podcast would get 300,000 in our first month. Guys, we got 2 million downloads in a matter of weeks. We were a hit! Jenna and I were thrilled, but we also felt a huge responsibility to the legacy of The Office to keep on delivering quality episodes. So that's what we've been doing.
People are always asking me, what is it like to work with your best friend? Their tone suggests our working together must be affecting our friendship in some negative way. I get why they ask. It's one thing to become friends with a coworker. It's another thing to maintain a friendship with someone who is your business partner. But the thing is, working together has strengthened our bond. I don't know how to explain it exactly, but I knew from the very beginning that working with Angela was right. As you've surely learned while listening to this book, we've navigated a lot of life together. I know how this woman shows up to a challenge, how she handles stress. I know her creative mind and her work ethic. I shared a jam brain with John Krasinski. I share an office lady's brain with Angela. Sometimes in life, you find a creative partner you just can't deny is a perfect fit. That's us.
That doesn't mean it's all been smooth sailing. We've gotten on each other's nerves several times. But one of the things I'm most grateful for is our ability to have honest, compassionate conversations that come from a place of wanting to build the other up. We know, without a shadow of a doubt, we have each other's backs. It's not scary to have one of us say, I'm not happy about something. We face criticism as an opportunity for growth. We've both learned so much about the depth of our friendship since starting our podcast. Being in the driver's seat, being the boss, and watching the podcast become a success is a true testament to our friendship. We get to put family first, and we get to do it our way. It's not lost on me that Jenna and I both have daughters who are watching us build this business. They are watching us model a strong female friendship and badass boss-latery. Boss-latery? Is that a term?
I like it.
Yeah, let's put it on a t-shirt. And you know, our sons are seeing it too. I couldn't be prouder of what we've built together.
It's been a wild few years. We kept our podcast going from our closets during a pandemic, added an Office Ladies animated series to our slate, and published the book you're listening to right now. So far, we've recorded over 100 episodes of Office Ladies and logged over 200 million downloads. Thanks to the folks at Pandora Music, our achievement was commemorated on a billboard in Times Square. Office Ladies was on a billboard in Times Square! I think it can be hard to imagine what we do all day. I know my family back home in St. Louis is mystified. Our social media often makes us look like two gals who shop at Target and laugh on a podcast together. And yes, that is true. But don't be fooled. We are calculating, hardworking, goal-centered boss ladies. We are constantly thinking, dreaming, doing, and raising the bar for ourselves. We sometimes work 7 days a week, but now it's on our terms. As I reflect on what we've built, I want to say this. After working for someone else for over 20 years, I couldn't be prouder of what Angela and I have created together. Most of my career was spent feeling as if I had to speak louder to get my voice heard, worrying that I'd be labeled difficult because I'm direct and ambitious. Even after being the lead of several projects after The Office, I never quite felt like I had the agency I wanted. I knew Angela felt the same. So rather than fight for another seat at their table, Angela and I created our own table. When women band together, we can do great things.
That's right. We created our own damn table, and you're all sitting here with us. I still can't believe the range of people who stop me to say they listen to our podcast and how much it means to them. College girls from Miami, a tough-as-nails middle-aged construction worker in Battery Park, a mother and daughter from North Carolina, two guys from London, a whole entire family from Brazil, and a dance group in Central Park. Honestly, the list goes on and on. After meeting the folks from Brazil, I called Jenna from a busy street and yelled, "Oh my God, we are global! Woohoo! We are badass boss ladies all over the world!" A bus was driving by, and she couldn't hear a word I said, but she knew I was happy. Jenna and I work so well together because we believe in each other. It's incredibly empowering. I can walk into any room with Jenna and feel like we can conquer it together. Folks listening to this, invest in the people in your lives. Find that friend who makes you feel 10 feet tall and bulletproof. Build them up and encourage them. Show up for each other no matter how big or small the occasion. Link arms and walk into any crowd, fake laughing like you own the world, and you will.
The end.
We did it. We finished our audiobook.
Thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, thanks for hanging out with us.
There's just one thing I need.
A little more Creed.
I need to hear it again.
Here's a tall tale, you could call it a yarn, about the office ladies and the show they spawned. They took our story and wrote it all down, little Angela and her friend Pom, Jenna and Ange, Pumpkin and Pam, go together like eggs and Spam. Their book's real cute, Rudy Toot Toot, Jenna and Ange, and which one's Pam?
We hope you enjoyed this production of The Office BFFs, Tales of the Office from Two Best Friends Who Were There.
Read by Jenna Fisher and Angela Kinsey, with guest appearances by Creed Bratton, Rainn Wilson, Oscar Nunez, Brian Baumgartner, Ellie Kemper, Steve Carell, Ed Helms, Kate Flannery, and Jennifer Garner.
And presented by Day Street Books and Harper Audio.
This program was directed by Dennis Kao and recorded at Outlaw Sound in Hollywood, California.
It was produced by Literati Audio, with additional post-production by Nathan Rossborough.
Executive producer, Suzanne Franco Mitchell.
Text copyright, 2022, by Jenna Fisher and Angela Kinsey.
Production copyright, 2022, by HarperCollins Publishers.
All rights reserved.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you!